This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Sound recording and editing was by Tom Hayes of Anglia Ruskin University, Cambridge. Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 5th of November 2008, our guest speaker was Professor Claudio Sardoni of the University of Rome La Sapienza, speaking on the theme Keynes, Marx and the General Theory. His talk was based on his chapter in the 1997 so-called second edition of the General Theory, published by Edward Elgar. You can also download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thank you, Mark. It's a real pleasure to participate in this seminar on the General Theory. And just because you mentioned the Jeff Farquhar, when I was a PhD student with him, not here but in Australia, we just did the same. We had a General Theory seminar, and every week we read a chapter and commented. So it's a sort of going back old days. Anyway, coming to my topic, I won't concentrate so much on the general theory as such, but more in general about Keynes' approach to the problem of effective demand, and in particular, I will concentrate on a draft of some chapters of the general theory, which were written in 1933. The reason why I do this is because it is in these drafts that we can find a connection between Keynes and Marx. And in fact, the first question to ask is that why Keynes and Marx. After all, they are very different people. Their politics, their ideologies were completely different. Of course, Keynes was a liberal, coming from the Anglo-Saxon tradition. Marx was a continental European socialist, and so on and so on. So, from this point of view, there is no connection at all between Marx and Keynes. And in fact, if we stick to the ideological aspects, we can always find in Keynes a very strong antipathy for Marx, Marxism, socialism, communism. So it's impossible to find a connection on this side of the problem. The connections, anyway, there is, in my view, a deeper connection between Keynes and Marx, which goes in a way to the root of the problem, in the sense that both Marx and Keynes, of course in different times, at different phases of their reflections, of their lives, but in both cases they came to the conclusion, to the conviction that the capitalist society and the capitalist economy in particular had come to the end of a historical phase and had entered into a different phase which for Marx should have led to the revolution, to socialism and so on. For Keynes the end of this phase meant different things, but in any case both were convinced that in the early phase of the capitalist system, the capitalist, the bourgeois society, and the capitalist economy had been a very progressive economic system, able to provide to ensure rate growth, a process of growth which had no it was unprecedented in history. The capitalist system was able to expand to such an extent that it could ensure to a large part of the society levels of welfare that were completely unknown in past history. In both cases, Marx and Keynes were convinced that this phase, this let's call it progressive phase of the capitalist society, had come to an end. Different times, of course, but for both, there was the conviction that the capitalist system had entered into a new phase in which this process of growth wasn't ensured any longer. The system has entered a phase in which, in a way, so to speak, the capitalist class had finished its historical mission. The capitalist class as a whole had become unable to ensure that growth and growing welfare that could have ensured before. And this is very clear for Marx. I don't have to underline this aspect, but it's important to underline, to stress that this was true also for Keynes, much earlier than the general theory. Even as early as in the 20s, when Keynes was concerned about the economic consequences of the First World War, this idea that the capitalist system had entered a new phase was very clear in Keynes' mind. So for this, I think, is the basic reason why, in a way, we are allowed to look at the relationships between the two. But apart from this very general point in common, there are other aspects which link the two in a more analytic sense. And this is what I'll try to do tonight. But first of all, let's start by looking at Keynes thought of Marx. It's not something unknown that Keynes was not a scholar of Marx. Keynes didn't know much about Marx. He probably read a few things, but his knowledge on Marx and Marx was based on secondary literature. Now, I don't have time to enter into its Keynes' sources, but it's very clear that what he knew, when he talked about Marx, he was drawing on things which had been said and developed by other people. Anyway, even though he didn't know Marx so well, this didn't prevent him, Keynes, from being very trenchant about Marx's economics in particular. As I said, the politics is very clear. He was very much against. In the general theory, Marx is quoted three times. The first time is about Keynes' definition of classical economics, which probably you have talked about. Anyway, it's not very important. He just wants to say that Marx's definition of classical economics is not his own, so it's not a very relevant quotation. The second quotation is more important, and this quotation happens when Keynes is talking about the great puzzle of fetid demand, and as you can read, he said this puzzle had vanished from economics since Malthus and only kept on living furtively in the underworlds. Not only Marx is put into the underworld, but Keynes was also convinced that the world will learn much more from Gesell than from Marx. I don't know if you know Gesell, but certainly he's a very obscure figure in the history of ideas. But anyway, this was Keynes' conviction. He was convinced that Marx, at the best, belonged to the underworld, anyway, he didn't say much about the fettid demand, much more than what Malthus had said. This opens another issue, but I won't enter into it. This is in general theory. There are other judgments by Keynes about Marx, either before and after the general theory. In 1925, as you can read, Keynes said Marx does Capital was an obsolete economic textbook, not only scientifically erroneous, but without interest or application for the modern world. In 1934, this is interesting because 1934, just 1 year after the drafts I was mentioning before, as you can see, Keynes' feelings were just about the same as his feelings about the Koran. Das Kapital was out of date, controversializing, extraordinarily unsuitable to give inspiration to so many people its contemporary economic value. And its contemporary economic value is nil. In 1942, after the general theory, writing to John Robinson, Keynes again said that his feeling about Marx was the same as before. Marx had a penetrating and original flair, but was a very poor thinker indeed. So, if we remain in what Keynes said in the general theory, what he occasionally said before and after, there isn't much to suggest that it's worth investigating more deeply into their analytical relationship. The reason why it's worth doing it, it's an exception in Keynes' thinking about Marx. This exception, as I said, is in this 1933 drafts, drafts chapters for the general theory. In these chapters, Keynes criticized Say's law in a way that is quite similar, close to the way in which Marx had criticized Say's law. Even more important is that in Keynes, in his explanation of the basic nature of the capitalist system, of the capital economy, refers directly to Marx by using a very well-known formula which was introduced by Marx. Let's have a look at this Keynes' critique of Say's law in 1933. Keynes' critique is based on the distinction between a cooperative economy, a neutral economy, and an entrepreneur or monetary economy. This is, he classifies these three possible kinds of economies. Keynes refers to Marx and recognizing that Marx, at starting from the formula MCM prime, had pointed out the fundamental nature of the capitalist economy. A cooperative economy, for Keynes, essentially is basically equivalent. Is essentially a barter economy. The factors of production are rewarded by share of the real output, and insofar as factors of production are rewarded in agreed proportions, money is only a transitory convenience. In other words, money is only used as a means of exchange, is just to buy a predetermined share of the output. A neutral economy is essentially the same as a cooperative economy. The difference is that in this case, in the case of a neutral economy, it's not necessary that all the factors income is used to buy a current a share of the current output. In other words, some income of the factors of production can be saved and used to buy a share of a pre-existing wealth. In any case, the economy works in the same way as a cooperative, the neutral economy works in the same way as a cooperative economy if the sellers of this existing wealth use the income they earn, the income they get from selling the existing wealth to buy current output. So also in a neutral economy, which is the most similar to what for Keynes classical neoclassical economists had in mind, if the economy works in this way, full employment is ensured. But the economy in which we live, the capitalist economy, is neither a cooperative or a neutral, nor a neutral economy. It's what Keynes calls an entrepreneurial economy or monetary economy. The fundamental difference is that in an entrepreneurial economy, the production is started and carried out by capitalists, by entrepreneurs, in order to earn profits, not to in order to produce more goods or employ more labor. The system is driven by the capitalist desire to maximize profits. That means that entrepreneurs use money to start production processes if they expect that this is profitable in terms of money. This makes the entrepreneurial economy essentially different from the neutral or cooperative economy. This economy works in this economy, money plays a fundamental, crucial role, and especially because if capitalists are interested in money profit, not in profits in terms of goods, but in terms of money. In other words, to put it simply, to get more money than what it was invested to produce. And the logical consequence is that if the entrepreneurs expect that by using their money to produce, they won't get profits, or they will get less profits than they consider satisfactory, the capitalists don't use money to start production processes, but they keep money idle, they keep money hoarded. In this way, production is reduced and unemployment rises, and so on and so on. This is the fundamental aspect of an entrepreneurial economy. If we can refer to this aspect by going back to what I said just at the beginning. In this sense, the entrepreneurial economy in Keynes' times, his conviction that the system has entered a new phase can be expressed in these terms, in the sense that while in the previous phase, capitalists as a whole, in general, always tend to convert money into production investment and then, in so doing, by ensuring growth. In the present phase, the tendency for the capitalist class as a whole to keep money idle, to prefer to keep their wealth in liquid form rather than convert it into production, is the feature that makes the capitalist system different from the previous phase. The system has entered a different phase because the tendency of the capitalist class as a whole to prefer liquidity rather than production and growth has become stronger, is much stronger than in the past. Now, of course, here we could start a discussion of why this approach to the problem, which is was used by Keynes in 1933, virtually disappears in the general theory as we know it in the 1936 edition of the general theory. There are several reasons, but unfortunately, I don't have time to enter into this kind of discussion. Certainly, it's rather surprising that in three years' time, Keynes radically changed his critique of Say's law and the way in which he approaches the whole problem of effective demand, and in particular, his reference to Marx. Which was quite evident, in these drafts, disappears completely. There are possible explanations, not completely satisfactory in my view. But in the paper should be on the website, in the paper I enter much more into this, into an attempt to explain why Keynes changed his mind in 3 years, from 1933 to the publication of the general theory. Here, now, I prefer to go to try to explain Marx's approach, to go back to Marx's formula MC M prime, and then to underline the analytical similarities between Keynes and Marx in this respect, and then also to stress the differences in terms of the explanation of how the economy works. So let's go back to Marx for a while. As I said, as you know, the formula MCM prime is a synthesis the how Marx sees the way in which the economy works, and here this is a quotation from the 1933 Keynes draft. Keynes explains quite clearly, quite satisfactorily the fundamental nature of Marx's interpretation of the capitalist system. Also for Marx, like for Keynes, capitalists produce in order to make money profits, and this is the sense of the formula MC M prime. That means capitalists advance an amount of money M to produce a certain amount of goods, commodities, C, which are sold on the market at value M prime, larger than M, and the difference between M prime and M is the profit. So the capitalist system is organized in such a way that the difference M prime minus M is maximized. This is the trust for capitalist production. From this approach, this vision of how the system works and why the system works, which is in common between Marx and Keynes, in terms of Marx's analysis, gives rise to analytical issues. The schemes of reproduction and the overproduction crisis. The schemes of reproduction, which are which were developed by Marx in the second book of the Capital, put it very simply, the schemes of reproduction are a way to explain how a system which is organized to produce and maximize profits can give rise to an orderly process of production, circulation, and growth. In other words, if we want to put it in terms, in modern terms, the schemes of reproduction are used by Marx to find the equilibrium conditions, the conditions under which the system gives rise to profits and grows in an orderly way without disproportions between sectors. Marx used a model with three sectors: consumption goods, investment goods, and luxury goods. But the schemes can be expanded to any number of sectors. So the schemes are used to this for these motives, and by looking at the schemes a bit more carefully, we find. It's possible to find an important element of similarity between Keynes and Marx. If we rewrite the formula MC and prime in this slightly changed version, M is the advanced money, C is the amounts of the amounts of means of production and labor. Both through M, by M, P is the production process, which gives rise to C prime, which is the larger amount of goods produced, which are sold by in the market at a value M prime, which, as I said, is larger than M. So M prime minus M is the monetary value of capitalist profits on the whole. Now, the problem Marx put at this juncture, Marx asks the question, the following question: M prime must of course be larger than M. Is this the origin of profits? But from where does this additional money come from? After all, capitalists had advanced M, and they are able, if everything works fine, are able to draw from the market an amount M prime, which is large. Where is the origin of this additional money? How come that by advancing M, the capitalist class as a whole is able to draw from circulation a larger amount of money? This is the question Marx asks, and his reply is the following. This additional quantity of money, this M prime minus M, necessarily comes from the capitalist class itself. It's the capitalist class itself which has to advance this additional money into, has to put this additional quantity of money into circulation. Why? Because in this way, by doing this, the capitalist class is able to finance its own consumption. The first step is to analyze a process of simple reproduction. Simple reproduction means that the whole profits are consumed by the capitalist class. So the system reproduces itself, but at the same scale. There is no growth, in other words. So this money can be advanced, this additional money can be advanced only by the capitalist class. The working class is not able to provide this additional money. They don't have additional money. They get a wage, and they use the wage to finance their own consumption. But this additional money, the origin of this additional money, it's money holds. In other words, the capitalist class as a whole holds a certain amount of its wealth in terms in the form of money, and this money, in order to make the system work, is disordered to finance consumption, and then at the end of the process, this additional money will come back to the capitalist class. While at the same time they are also able to have the physical surplus, the physical amount of goods which have been produced and then it will be consumed by them. Now, of course, we could go into this aspect more carefully, introduce some more complications like the velocity of circulation of money, several different problems, aspects. But the important point is that if we follow this sort of reasoning, the analytical conclusion is that aggregate profits in terms of money, the monetary value of aggregate, is determined by the capitalist consumption decisions. If the capitalist class does not disord money and put additional money into circulation, it would be impossible to realize profits. There would be a larger physical output, but this larger physical output could not be sold in the market, and so profits could not be realized. In order that this happens, capitalists must disorder money and use this disordered money to finance their consumption. So we can anticipate and say that the realization of profits, which is the thing which counts for the capitalist class, is not physical output, it's the monetary value of profits, are realized because at a certain time in the process the capitalist class decides to transform money, to put additional money into circulation, and in order to finance its consumption, and this gives the system the possibility to reproduce itself in an orderly way. When we come to expanded reproduction, that is when the economy grows. Essentially, we are in the same picture. The difference is that now not all capitalists don't consume the entire profits. Part of the profits are spent partly to finance consumption and partly to finance additional investment, to new expenditure on productive capacity. So the additional money which is put into circulation now is split in two parts. One part is devoted to finance consumption, and another part is devoted to finance investment goods, the purchase of investment goods. Again, we can complicate things as much as we like, but essentially the basic point is this one. So in the end, if we look at the schemes, we have that in both, if we compare simple and expanded reproduction, we have that the monetary value of aggregate profits is the same, but in the first case is entirely consumed, in the second case is used for consumption and for investment. So in this way the system is able to grow. the basic point, the basic conclusion is that aggregate the monetary value of aggregate profits depend on capitalist expenditure decisions. Now, if you are familiar with Keynes, but in particular with the work of Kalesky, this way of reading the schemes of Marx's schemes of reproduction brings to the conclusion which was also Kalesky's Kalesky's work on the schemes of reproduction. The conclusion is that the capitalist class as a whole gets what they spend. In other words, the amount, the value of the profits the capitalist class makes depends on what the capitalist class decides to spend, either in consumption or in investment goods. On the other hand, the working class spend what they get. The working class spend for consumption what they get, the wage they get from the capitalist class. Kalesky, well, we can talk about a bit of Kalesky if we have time later on. Now I prefer to keep going. So this, in this sense, there is an important similarity between Keynes and Marx, because in Keynes, like in Marx, it's the crucial decisions are the capitalist class decisions about spending, about profitability, spending, and liquidity preference. If both for Keynes and for Marx, the capitalist class has a high liquidity preference, so it doesn't use money to buy consumption goods or investment goods. So investment goods, in particular, are the crucial variable. The economy won't work in the let's say, to be short, in the optimal way. There will be a deficiency of demand. let's look at Marx. If the capitalist class decides to advance an amount of additional money which is less than what is required to have the results we just saw, this brings about a phenomenon of excess supply, because the amount of commodities which are in the market face an amount of money which is less than what is required to ensure the profits for the capitalist class. And this is, from this point of view, the similarity with Keynes is very evident. The level of income and then the level of employment in Keynes depends on, essentially depends on investment decisions which are taken by the capitalist class and depend on their liquidity preference, in very general terms. Then there are other complications, of course, there is the interest rate and so on and so on. From this point of view, it's my conviction that there is this important similarity between Marx and Keynes, analytical similarity. There are also important differences. And these differences come out when we refer to the second analytical issue that I mentioned before. One, I said, is the schemes of reproduction. The other one is the problem of crisis and overproduction crisis. The problem of crisis was dealt with by Marx essentially not so much in the Capital, but in another book, Theories of Surplus Value, which was meant to be the fourth book of the Capital, but was never published. It remained as a manuscript. Let's try to see the nature of our production crisis by using the schemes of reproduction we I referred before. As I said, if the capitalists decide to advance an additional quantity of money, M second, which is smaller than prime, this means that the level of aggregate profits will be negatively affected. There won't be enough demand to absorb the whole output and give rise to the normal level of profits. There will be a phenomenon of excess supply, and this can take two different forms. Either stocks of commodities pile up. In other words, it's impossible to sell the whole produced commodities, or the price of commodities fall, and because the prices fall, and in both cases, even there is a piling up of stocks of commodities, or the price fall down, there will be a reduction in profits. So every time the capitalists don't advance the required amount of money, there will be a decrease in profits. Now, Marx may be, in some occasions, very few occasions, he might have mentioned the problem of the fact that stocks of commodities pile up, by essentially concentrating on the fact that any time there is a deficiency of demand, there will be a fall in prices. And this gives rise to what he called a general production overproduction crisis. That means that the total demand is insufficient to ensure that the total output is sold and profits are realized at their normal level. If we think about what we said until now, this general production crisis is caused by an increase in the capitalist propensity to hold. Capitalists don't advance the required amount of money for the normal working of the system. They show a high propensity, a high liquidity preference. They prefer to keep money, to keep their income well in the form of money, rather than to transform it into commodities by going in the market and buying means of production and hiring workers. This quotation, which is on the screen, is very clear. In overproduction crisis, of course, when the demand for the general commodity, money, is greater than the demand for all particular commodities. In other words, the motive to turn the commodity into money, to realize its exchange value, prevails over the motive to transform the commodity again into use value. And here there is also a further step. Now the capitalist liquidity preference increases when capitalists think that to convert money into goods or labor is not profitable. Every time their expectations, now of course Marx used the term expectations, but it's not so clear, not in the same as much as we do now, as much as Keynes does in the general theory. But in any case, if we translate into more modern terms, we can say that any time the capitalist expectations are such that they expect lower profits than normal, they don't convert money into goods and labor, and then this gives rise to an overproduction crisis. Essentially, crises are due to an increase in the propensity to in the liquidity preference of the capitalist class. This aspect is very similar to what we can find in the general theory. Liquidity, the capitalist class as a whole can show at a certain time a degree of liquidity preference such that the economy doesn't realize full employment. And this is really the point. While in Keynes is very, we know that the mechanism is such that to explain why the system is not able to always ensure full employment, in Marx things are different. A high liquidity preference, the way in which I described it, gives rise to a crisis. It gives rise to, in other words, to a serious market perturbation. Prices fall down. Prices fall down, production reduces, and so on, and of course unemployment rises. So in Marx, the mechanism always necessarily gives rise to an overproduction crisis, to phenomena of excess supply in the market, prices falling down, with the consequences of having more unemployment, reduction in the output, and so on. But this is not true in Keynes. In Keynes, we can have high liquidity preference, a low level of effective demand, but nonetheless, the economy doesn't experience a market perturbation. In other words, we can have that supply and demand are equal, but at a lower level than full employment. In other words, it's not necessary to have market perturbation to have underemployment equilibrium, or if you want to put it even more straight, in Keynes it's possible to find to determine underemployment equilibrium, which we know, and it's the object. Then we can discuss what we mean by equilibrium, but in any case it's one of the central aspects of the generality. In Marx, despite all the similarities, the possibility to explain an underemployment equilibrium, there is no such possibility. In Marx, at the best, we can explain why the system goes through crisis, what he calls overproduction crisis or general gluts. Now, unfortunately, I don't have time, but I just say it, and then if you want, we can come back in the discussion. The reason why there is this basic difference is not a little difference, because while the kind of crisis Marx envisaged are not so frequent in the history of the economic system, we experience much more frequently, or maybe always, phenomena of underemployment equilibrium. In other words, the system doesn't have to go through crisis of the sort of Marx talked of, while equilibrium under the level of full employment is a very common aspect of the capitalist system. Why this difference? Well, what I argue in the paper and in the paper which is on the website and in other works is that this essentially depends on the fact that it's a bit paradoxical, but it depends on the fact that while Keynes was based his analysis, the general theory, on Marshallian micro foundations, microeconomics is Marshallian. While Keynes did this, and this is very very clear, Marx based this analysis on a vision of how the single firm, in other words, he had different micro foundations based on a general view of the classical economists, in which which are such that it's impossible to arrive at the same conclusion as Keynes. Now, I just said it without the demonstration, but I don't think I have time to do it. So paradoxically, and I conclude, paradoxically, the Marshallian macro foundations of Keynes, which to a large extent, in my view, are less satisfactory than the classical micro foundations, provide Keynes with the possibility to explain a phenomenon like underemployment equilibrium, or to be more general, underemployment rest states, which is much more common, it's much more typical of the of how the capitalist economies work, rather than the huge overproduction crisis that Marx talked of as characteristic of the capitalist economy.